Salam sejahtera. Menghadap Duli Yang Teramat Mulia Raja Muda Perak, Raja Nazrin Shah Ibni Sultan Azlan Mohibuddin Shah, Eminent Fellow Institute of Strategic and International Studies, ICS Malaysia, Ampun Tuanku, beribu ampun, Sembah Patik mohon diampun, Patik mewakili ICS berafat sembah, menjunjung setinggi-tinggi kasih di atas perkenan Tuanku berangkat mencemar Duli ke majlis pada pagi ini. Ampun Tuanku, mohon izin Patik meneruskan ucapan dalam bahasa Inggeris. Yang berbahagia Dato' Haris On bin Hussein, representing Yang Berhormat Dato' Sri Hishamuddin. Yang berbahagia Tan Sri, Yang Amat Berbahagia Tun Suhaila, Tan Sri Haji Muhammad Noor, wife of the late Tun Hussein On. Yang berbahagia Tan Sri Datuk Sri Muhammad Jawa Hassan, Chairman ICS Malaysia. Yang berbahagia Datin Paduka Dr. Farida Abdullah, Chairman the NOAA Foundation. Yang berbahagia Datuk Dr. Mahani Zainal Abidin, Chief Executive ICS Malaysia. Your Excellencies, distinguished guests, ladies and gentlemen. It's a great honor and pleasure, but also a very daunting and humbling task to address an august audience such as this one. I would like to begin by expressing my deep appreciation to His Royal Highness Raja Nazrin Shah Ibni Sultan Azlan Mohibuddin Shah, the Crown Prince of Perak Darul Ridzwan. I've had the privilege of interacting with His Royal Highness over the last 30 years since our PhD days in Boston. His Royal Highness has been an inspiration and very supportive of my return to Malaysia. Thank you, Your Royal Highness, for taking time to grace the occasion today. It's also a pleasure and privilege to make this inaugural address in the presence of Yang Berbahagia Dato' Haris On bin Tun Hussein, representing Yang Berhormat Dato' Sri Hishamuddin bin Tun Hussein On. Thank you, Yang Berbahagia Dato', for honoring this occasion. I hope very much to interact with Dato and Yang Berhormat Dato Sri Hishamuddin in developing the programmatic trust of the chair. I would also like to take this opportunity to thank the NOAA Foundation for its invaluable support in establishing Tun Hussein On Chair at ICS Malaysia. Without the support of the foundation, this chair would not have been possible. Thank you, Datin Paduka, Dr. Farin Abdullah, Chairman of the NOAA Foundation, for your support. It's a great honor and privilege to be the first holder of the Tun Hussein On Chair in International Studies. I will do my utmost to promote the purpose of the chair and to advance its domestic and international profile. Along with the Chairman of ICS Malaysia, Tan Sri Dato' Sri Muhammad Jawa Hassan, and Chief Executive Dato' Dr. Mahani Zainal Abidin, I will endeavor to establish firm intellectual and programmatic foundations for the chair. The late Tun Hussein On was a man of great honesty, integrity, conviction, and steely courage, who put service to country ahead of self. He is a leader to be admired and emulated. Coming from a family that played central administrative and political roles in Johor and the formation of Malaya, Tun was deeply committed to the unity of the Malaysian nation. Recognizing the complexities of building a multi-ethnic nation, Tun Hussein took firm action on key issues in education, finance, trade, and industry. His warnings and actions against corruption in public life, however stern and unpopular they have been at that time, were prophetic. They reflect his deep conviction that uplifting the Malay community and building a united Malaysian nation would be undermined by the lack of integrity and by corruption in public institutions. Tun Hussein On did not hesitate to act against these vices. Believing that a stable and secure regional environment was crucial for the attainment of domestic goals, Tun was actively engaged as well on the regional and international stages. He proactively sought a settlement of the Cambodian conflict. Concerned with developments that could have a negative impact on the national security of Malaysia, Tun Hussein authorized a big build-up of the Malaysian Armed Forces during his tenure as Prime Minister. At that time, I was a serving military officer working in the Defense Planning Department in the Ministry of Defense. In that capacity, I had the privilege of interacting with and observing firsthand Thun's meticulous and methodological approach to problems that have become his hallmark. Subsequently, I also had the pleasure of working with Thun Hussein when he became chairman of ISIS Malaysia. Having taken early retirement from the Malaysian Armed Forces, I was then a senior fellow at ISIS Malaysia. While authorizing a big military buildup, Thun recognized that Malaysia's national security hinged even more on national unity and resilience at home. Building a united and strong Malaysian nation was very much at the heart of the endeavors of Thun Hussein On and his father, Dato' On. The topic of my inaugural address on nation-making stems from that concern. Thun Hussein's deep commitment to the nation and his selflessness were reflected both in his decision to rejoin UMNO over the objections of some of his family members and by his decision to hand over power as soon as he realized that the state of his health would not permit him to carry the burden of the duties of Prime Minister. Rare indeed a person who would pass on power when he is at the helm. My second reason for accepting the chair was the opportunity to return to Malaysia after more than 20 years in the United States. My wife and I have a special fondness for Malaysia and for ISIS Malaysia, where I began my second career. The chair provides a good platform from which I hope to make a contribution to the development of international studies in Malaysian universities and research institutes like ISIS Malaysia and MIDAS. Subject to the availability of funds, I look forward to initiating a signature project on the state of international studies in Malaysia to assess demand and supply, with the ultimate goal of developing a world-class school of international studies in Malaysia, comparable to prestigious schools in the United States, United Kingdom, Australia, China, and India. Based on the visiting positions I've held in schools and universities in these countries, I'm convinced that with commitment, resources, and flexibility, Malaysia can be a center of excellence in international studies. Malaysia is a trading nation that has made a mark in international affairs. Sriwijaya and the Malacca Sultanate were important players on the regional stage during the periods of their dominion. Malaysia today is an important player in ASEAN and regional affairs, as well as in global affairs. We should develop forward-looking ideas and intellectual frameworks to support our engagement in the region and the world, as well as develop a strong human resource base to pursue our interests and contribute to regional and international peace, security, and prosperity. Government departments, the private sector, civil society, and international society all require suitably educated and trained personnel in international studies. Although we have some training programs, we do not appear to have strong international studies programs in universities. We do not have a school of international studies or strong peer-reviewed journals in that field or an international studies association. Expertise in international studies is crucial for Malaysia to be internationally competitive and contribute to national, regional, and international peace, security, and prosperity in a globalizing world. Our goal should not only be numbers and paper qualifications, but also excellence, honesty, and integrity, all qualities well exemplified by the late Thun Hussein On. Before I move on to my lecture, please allow me to express my deep appreciation to my wife, Kalyani, who is in the audience. She has been the most important pillar of support both in my career, first in the Malaysian Armed Forces, and subsequently in my academic career. I will now proceed with my lecture, which is titled Nation Making in Asia from Ethnic to Civic Nations? My lecture is rather long, and I don't really want to hold everyone to this long lecture. I'm told that it is in printed form, and a booklet will be distributed to everyone at the end of the event today. So I will try and keep this presentation of the talk as brief as possible, but without losing the substance of the talk. I also want to mention that this piece of work is still a work in progress, and I hope very much to be able to do further work on this before making it available for publication. I had to write this piece concurrent with settling in after coming back from overseas after an absence of 20 years, as well as renovating my house. So I've tried to give this as much attention as possible. I think it's a very important topic. Nation-making in Malaysia is very important at this point in time. And I've tried to set this in context by looking at nation-making in Asia as a whole. Because very often we tend to look at problems at home and not realize that other people are also experiencing similar concerns and problems. So my purpose here is to set the context for thinking about Malaysia, but in by using the Asia as the landscape. And I want to begin by saying that the nation state is the fundamental building block of domestic and international politics. The power of countries rests not just on material power, economic and military power, but also on ideational power and legitimacy of the nation state. A country that is weak in ideational and nation state dimensions cannot be a great power for long, as demonstrated by the collapse of the Soviet Union. The state of the nation state is thus crucial. Yet international relations scholarship has largely ignored the political unit. Most analysts in the scholarly, political, and think tank communities often take the sovereign nation state for granted, and we speak of China, India, Malaysia, Indonesia as though they all are the same political units. It's very important, in fact, to understand the state of the political unit of the country that we are talking about. Originating in Europe, the idea of nation state has a much longer history in that continent. Many Asian countries have long histories, thousands of years, if not, and some have hundreds of years of history. But as modern nation states, most Asian countries are relatively new. Except for Japan and for Thailand, nearly all Asian countries emerged as modern nation states after World War II. It is possible to date China's emergence as a modern nation state to 1911, after the Nationalist Revolution to overthrow the Qing dynasty. But from 1911 to 1949, China was engaged in internal struggle, and the contemporary form of China essentially dates from 1949. All other states in Asia emerged as modern nation states after World War II. And even as they emerged as modern nation states, they were really aspirational states. They were not states in fact. Construction of nations, construction of political systems, construction of governments, all of this began at that point in time and are continuing through the present time. So constructing nation states is a major task and has important domestic and international implications. Let me illustrate this by looking at three aspects of the nation state. First is the political system. A political system is the means through which one can acquire and exercise power. And many countries in Asia still do not have stable political systems. Political systems in Thailand, in Pakistan, in many other countries have been continually contested. Even the established political systems like that in India, Malaysia, and Singapore have come under stress. It is possible that political systems in China, Vietnam, and Burma may undergo change. And political system change has dramatic consequences both internally and internationally. For example, the shift from the guided democracy of Sukarno to the new order of Suharto brought about a fundamental change in the international orientation of Indonesia, especially in relations with Malaysia, the end of confrontation, as well as the establishment of ASEAN and the development of regional cooperation in Southeast Asia. Likewise, the shift from the Suharto's new order to the parliamentary order of the present-day Indonesia also brought about fundamental change in Indonesia's international orientation. Another major task in the context of building nation states is building state institutions. Building state institutions is an unfinished task in many, many countries. Building effective judiciary, police forces, armed forces, bureaucracies, these are all major tasks. And not many countries have established strong, credible institutions. The hallmarks of a modern state are one, monopoly over the legitimate use of violence within the territory, and number two is compulsory jurisdiction within territories. And if you look around the countries in Asia today, how many can we say has really monopoly over the legitimate use of violence within their territories and also compulsory jurisdiction over all people living within their territories? So we still have not achieved most of the fundamental criteria of nationhood and statehood in Asia. We now are very much concerned, and we are very proud of the fact that Asian countries are rising. We very frequently talk about the rise of China, of India, of Asia, talk of Asian century, and Asia is becoming the hub of the world. These are very common places, and we have someone in Singapore who talks about the shifting hemisphere, very important in terms of the growing importance of Asia. But to me, the Achilles heel of Asia is nation-state making. Many of the countries in Asia are still weak as modern nation-states. And until and unless we can build stable and effective political systems, state institutions, and cohesive nations, it is not possible, in fact, to realize the dream of Asian century. So I think the political unit is very important, but it has been ignored. And I hope very much this morning to focus on this issue and to rectify the shortcomings that my colleagues, both in the scholarly and policy worlds, have indulged. I mean, they're very much concerned about the changing distribution of power. I think that's very important. But at the same time, I think it's important to understand the state of the political unit in Asia. So I'm going to focus my remarks on nation-making. The construction of a nation is an ongoing process. Nations are being continually made and unmade. We are conversant with the term nation-building. But nation-building, we look at it in positive terms. But nation-building also means nation-marginalizing and nation-destroying, which we often do not look at. So I think we ought to look at, hence my choice of the term nation-making instead of nation-building. Nations are being made continually, and they're being unmade as well. Competing narratives have been advanced in the making of nations. Quite often they lead to bitter struggle and the unmaking of nations. For example, Singapore leaders contested the basis for nationhood in Malaysia, leading to the separation of Singapore from Malaysia in 1965. East Pakistan leaders contested the basis for the Pakistani nation and state, as well as their position within that country, leading to civil war and ultimately the formation of Bangladesh in 1971. Tibetans and Uyghurs contest their inclusion in the Chinese nation. The Moro Muslims contest the inclusion in the Philippines. The Malay Muslims in southern Thailand contest the inclusion in that country. Until recently, the Achenese did not identify with the Indonesian nation and contested the inclusion in the Indonesian state. The Papuans still do not identify with Indonesia. The Chin, Kachin, Shan, and other nationality groups contest the inclusion in Burma. The Tamils contest the basis for nationhood in Sri Lanka. The Kashmiris seek a separate nation and state free of Pakistan and India. Several minority groups in Northeast India contest the inclusion in the Indian nation and state. Some Baluchis and Sindhis imagine their own nations and contest the inclusion in Pakistan. For the most part, these communities seek separate states based on their ethnic communities. The demand for new nation states is not restricted to minority ethnic communities. To complete their nations, some countries seek to unify divided nations and states. North Vietnam forcibly absorbed South Vietnam to create a unified Vietnamese nation state. North and South Korea seek to unify and create a unified Korean nation state, if necessary, through the use of force. In the name of a united Chinese nation, Beijing seeks to unify Taiwan with the mainland. Nation-making and unmaking have broad political and geostrategic ramifications as well. For example, the Soviet collapse dramatically reconfigured political space in Central and Eastern Europe. It led to the creation of many new nation-states, including Russia, Lithuania, Latvia, Estonia, Ukraine, Belarus, Kazakhstan, Turkmenistan, Uzbekistan, Azerbaijan, Armenia, Georgia, and Moldavia. The breakup of Yugoslavia gave birth to Serbia and Montenegro, Croatia, Bosnia and Herzegovina, Macedonia, Slovenia, and Kosovo. Czechoslovakia split to form the Czech Republic and Slovakia. East and West Germany unified to create the German Democratic Republic. These dissolutions and unifications have had far greater impact on the geostrategic landscape of Europe, Central Asia, and the world than the changes in the distribution of power. Very often we talk about the U.S. emerging as the sole global power. But if you look at these developments, both the dissolution of the Soviet Union as well as the unification of Germany, they've had far more important repercussions and consequences for security in Europe. The dissolution of the Soviet Union effectively terminated the Cold War, affecting not only Europe but also the world. Unification of the two Germanies altered the political, security, and economic dynamics of Europe. Reconfiguration of political units had another major impact. It effectively arrested the move away from the sovereign state to a single Europe. Today, nation states are still very much alive. It was common to pronounce the death of sovereign nation states in the 80s and 90s. In contrast to Europe, the post-World War II Asian political map has been relatively stable, but not without change. The formation of Malaysia in 1965 and the subsequent separation of Singapore altered the political landscape in maritime Southeast Asia. The breakaway of East Pakistan in 1971 altered the political and geostrategic landscape in South Asia. The unification of North and South Vietnam in 1976 altered the geostrategic landscape in continental Southeast Asia. Since then, there has been no change to the Asian political map. However, we cannot assume that will continue. Reconfiguration of political space is a constant in history. Take Malaysia, for example. It dates only from 1965. Before that, the Federation of Malaya, Singapore, North Borneo, and Sarawak all existed as separate entities. Prior to the formation of Federation of Malaya, its constituent units existed as part of the Strait Settlement, Federated Malay States, or as Unfederated Malay States. Before the colonial period, these kingdoms and sultanates existed as separate entities. In still earlier times, they were part of empires that straddle present-day Indonesia and Malaysia. Political space in our own backyard has undergone several configurations. We cannot assume that the political units of today will continue to exist in two or three decades from now. Change is a constant. Aspirations for states are strong in so-called minority communities in China, Philippines, Thailand, Indonesia, Burma, India, Sri Lanka, Nepal, Pakistan, and several Central Asian countries. If successful, they will substantially alter the political and economic geostrategic space. For example, if Tibet and Xinjiang were to separate from China, that will dramatically alter the territorial and political configuration of that country, as well as the Asian geostrategic landscape. Likewise, if China's claim to Taiwan is successful, or if North and South Korea unify under a common political system, that would dramatically alter the political, economic, and geostrategic landscape in Northeast Asia and Asia as a whole. My point is that the political configuration of countries could alter, sometimes in a dramatic fashion, as it happened with the Soviet Union and Central and Eastern Europe, and that will have far-reaching domestic and international consequences. The idea of a sovereign state for a national community has become strongly embedded in Asian political elites. It has become a key driver of domestic and international politics in Asia. The nation state is not going away. The task at hand is to review the base and strengthen the legitimacy and capacity of nations and states in Asia. We should not take them for granted, wish them away, or curtail their sovereign rights and responsibilities in the name of larger regional communities. Those who envision single political and economic communities in Southeast and East Asia, for example, must take this reality into account. and rethink their visions, goals, and strategies for the region. I will not elaborate on this as it will take me too far afield. It's another lecture for another day. Permit me to make another point here. Throughout history, survival of states was not only a function of international anarchy or change in the distribution of power, as propounded by realist theories and scholars. Contestations over legitimacy of nations and states has been a key driver as well of state survival and extinction. The reconfiguration of European political and geostrategic space in the 1990s, for example, was brought about not by change in the distribution of power, but by the dissolution and unification of states in Europe in the 1990s. Dissolution and unification were driven largely by domestic developments focused on the legitimacy of nations and states. The state of the political unit continues to be critical, but as I mentioned at the outset, it has been ignored by scholars of international politics and by policymakers who make international interaction. To rectify that shortcoming, I propose in my lecture today to focus on the political unit with special emphasis on nation-making. Nation has become the primary basis for imagining contemporary political communities and constructing modern states. There can be no contemporary state without a nation. In situations where there is no coherent nation, the state sets about constructing one. Nation and state have become so fused that the only legitimate contemporary political unit is the nation-state. In the lecture, I will explore the meaning of nation and identify approaches to nation-making, and then advance a basic argument and what I think has happened and what are the problems with what has happened, and suggest a way of getting around the problem. First, what is a nation? We talk very much about nation-making, but we should understand or at least have some idea in terms of what we mean by nation. And the concept of nation, like many social science concepts, is contested. There is no precise definition, and that is not very helpful. There are many definitions, objective definitions, which suggest that we know the nation, nations out there waiting to be discovered. And then there are subjective definitions, which suggest that we know the nation only in post hoc terms. Only after it comes into being do we know nations. I do not intend to get into the debate of these polar opposites, but I want to suggest that nations possess a rich heritage of memories. The people in that nation have a desire to live together and preserve the inheritance that has been handed down. There is a common past, a common culture, and a shared destiny. The nation is an outcome of long paths of efforts and belief in a shared or common destiny. In my view, common history, shared destiny, and a set of beliefs are crucial in the making of a nation. I subscribe to the idea that nations are imagined and constructed, and that nationalism precedes and constructs a nation. Indonesia, for example, was constructed by the anti-colonial nationalists. It was not out there waiting to be discovered. The anti-colonial nationalists imagined Indonesia as a nation of nations that was the former Dutch East Indies. So it was an imagination, but imagination cannot be at will. Cultural and political history are important, and circumstances are crucial. Often nationalism selectively deploys mytho-history and culture in the construction of persuasive narratives for a nation. How are nations made? Nation-making may take several forms, but basically there are two approaches. There are many variations, but at base there are two approaches. One is on the basis of ethnic or religious community, and the other is on the basis of citizenship, equality, and commitment to a political ideology. The first may be called ethnic nation-making, and the second, civic nation-making. The two approaches are not mutually exclusive. They share some common elements, like territory and common culture, but they also have distinctive features. Citizens' interests take center stage in a civic nation. Group beliefs and interests dominate an ethnic nation. Ethnic nation-making has been most common in Asia. of the 14 countries investigated in my study, 11 have followed the approach of ethnic nation making. Only 3 have followed the path of civic nation making. In ethnic nation making, the nation is constructed on the basis of ethnic cause. Common roots, emotional attachment, group loyalty, and rule by ethnic majority are the key elements of ethnic nation making. Community unity is achieved through birth, common descent, or cultural and religious assimilation. To be assimilated into an ethnic community, a new member has to lose his or her previous identity. The ethnic nation is supreme. It constructs the individual and who is subordinate to the group. Ethnic cause were the basis for many kingdoms and traditional states in an earlier era. With the rise of nationalism, ethnic groups came to be viewed as a proper basis for national political communities in Central and Eastern Europe, like Germany, Poland, Russia, all ethnic nation states. Ethnicity is also the most common basis for a nation state making in Asia. However, it is important to distinguish between ethnic group and nation. Many in academia conflate and confuse ethnic group and nation. As a result, people term Malaysia as a multinational state. That is incorrect. Malaysia is a multi-ethnic nation or a multi-ethnic state, but it is not a multinational state. There is a Malay nation of recent vintage, but Malaysian Chinese, Indians, Kadazan, and Dayaks have not envisaged separate nations, at least thus far. Their national aspirations are captured in the articulations of a Malaysian nation. My point is that not all ethnic groups are nations. Hence, it is incorrect to term Malaysia as a multinational state. Why and how certain groups become nations and others not is an important question to explore beyond the scope of my lecture. Civic nation-making. Unlike ethnic nation-making, which is grounded in common descent, language, and custom, civic nation-making emphasizes political creed, historic territory, legal political community on the basis of citizenship, equality of all citizens, and a common culture and ideology. Originating in Western Europe and North America, the civic approach is predominantly a spatial or territorial concept, with each nation possessing a well-defined ideology and historic territory. The civic nation is based on a community of laws, institutions, and common political will. All community members have equal civil, political, and legal rights and duties. All are bound by the rule of law. Membership is through citizenship, not birth or descent. Ethnicity is not a hallmark of this approach. The emphasis is on individuals, not groups. There is no state-bearing ethnic nation. Nations are forged by the state of all people living in the defined land. So those are the two basic approaches to nation-making, ethnic and civic. And I want to stress here that ethnic nation-making and civic nation-making are not mutually exclusive. They overlap in certain ways, but each has its own characteristics. Now let me set out my argument, and before that I should have some water, I think. Thank you, Tansri, and my apologies for the audience running dry. My basic argument is this. Ethnicity has dominated nation-making in Asia. As I mentioned, of the 14 countries I studied in this project, 11 have followed ethnic making approach. Only 3 have followed the civic nation-making approach. Ethnic nation-making has been productive of domestic and international conflict in several ways. And let me set them out. First, in multi-ethnic countries, constructing nations on the basis of majority communities implicitly or explicitly led to the formation of minority communities and their marginalization. frequently, what happens is the disadvantaged or marginalized groups become apprehensive about their futures, stimulating alternative concepts of a nation, as well as imagination of new states in which minority communities would become the state-bearing nation. In other words, the minority would become the majority in the new nation state. This, in turn, created apprehensions among new minority communities, setting a vicious cycle in motion. The demand for new nations and states frequently led to violence and war. In a few cases, such domestic conflicts have invited international military intervention. Second, ethno-national imaginations in homogeneous populations were unaccepting of divided nations and of the idea that one nation can support more than one state. So, for example, imaginations in North and South Vietnam did not accept the fact that there could be two Vietnamese states. The idea was that there's one Vietnamese nation and there must be one Vietnamese state. Likewise, in North and South Korea, there's no acceptance that one Korean nation can support two states. The ethno-national imagination is that there can only be one Vietnamese nation and one Vietnamese, or one Korean nation and one Korean state. So that was the second consequence, and this kind of imagination underscored the First Indochina War and the Second Indochina War, as well as the ongoing conflict on the Korean Peninsula, across the Taiwan Straits, and between India and Pakistan over Kashmir. Third, ethnic nation-making challenged civic nation-making. For example, ethnic nation-making in Aceh and Papua challenges the civic nation in Indonesia. Likewise, ethnic nation-making in India of the Kashmiris, of the Manipuris, the Mizora, the Nagas challenge the civic nation-making in the Indian state. Fourth, ethnic nation-making polarized populations, making them intolerant and unaccepting of plurality and diversity. The forging of a cohesive national community becomes much more difficult, if not impossible. Finally, it made societies intolerant of migration. Migration termed in terms of international flow of labor in a globalized world. And it also exacerbated racially based animosities between certain exclusive ethnic nation states, for example, between Korea and Japan, or between Korea and China. In sum, nation-making on the basis of ethno-nationalism has been the cause of numerous domestic and international conflicts in post-World War II Asia. Some of these conflicts continue to define domestic and international politics in Asia. So continuation of ethno-national imaginations and nation-making will lead to further strife and the proliferation of new states. There will be no end to the proliferation of new states on the basis of ethnic nations. Ongoing international and domestic conflicts will not be resolved. In fact, some may be exacerbated and new conflicts may arrive. And if ethnicity continues to dominate nation-making, nations will not command the loyalty of all their citizens, and national political communities will remain divided and brittle. Asian countries would remain weak as modern nation-states and unable to realize their full potential. And despite the growing material power of Asian countries, the dream of an Asian century will not come to pass. It will remain as a dream. One way to mitigate the negative consequences of ethnicity is to overlay ethnic conceptions with features of civic nation that emphasizes territory, citizenship, and equality. Although it is not a panacea, civic nation-making appears better placed to cope with diversity and the challenges of modernization, as well as manage and resolve domestic and international conflicts. It does not marginalize groups and nations in the interest of building Startswalk nations. The civic nation approach thus has the potential to enhance the legitimacy of the nation state in the eyes of all groups. It can also release the full potential of all citizens. And increased legitimacy of nation and state will help ameliorate domestic and international conflict, leading to increased regional stability. Strengthening civic nation may seem a tall order or pie in the sky, as ethnicity is deeply embedded in political organization, mobilization, and governance in Asian countries. I recognize ethnicity is not easily dislodged. attempts to do so could provoke counter-reaction and violence, and ethnicity is not all evil. However, when it becomes the primary basis for nationalism and national identity, it does produce the negative consequences set out earlier. Civic nation-making, on the other hand, despite its difficulties, is on the uptake in Asia. Political creed is becoming important and more significant, even in ethnically homogeneous countries like Japan, South Korea, and Taiwan. And civic nation-making is firmly embedded in India and Indonesia. National communities in these countries are held together not only by ethnic consciousness, but also by political loyalty, obligations, and rights. Strengthening civic nation features would foster peace, stability, and prosperity in the region and help make Asia the core region of the world. Now, that is my basic argument, that ethnic nation-making makes for conflict and instability, and civic nation-making or strengthening the civic nation features can increase national stability and regional security and prosperity. And I have 14 case studies. Obviously, I cannot go into the 14 case studies, but I want to give you one or two illustrations and also with particular reference to Malaysia, since we are all Malaysians and we are very interested in nation-making in Malaysia. But let me first deal with China. In China, there is a tension in the conception of nation between a territorial conception and an ethnic conception. After 1911, the nationalist revolution against the Qing dynasty, Sun Yat-sen conceptualized the Chinese nation on the basis of the Han Chinese nation. But very soon he realized that conceptualizing the Chinese nation on the basis of the Han Chinese would mean losing half the territory of China. So the nationalists in China discarded the Han Chinese nation as the basis for the Chinese nation. They then redefined the Chinese nation to include the Manchu, the Mongol, the Hui, the Tibetan, as well as the Han Chinese, and the many other minority groups. Today, formally, China comprises 56 ethnic groups, of which the Han Chinese are the majority. So in formal terms, China is close to a civic nation. But in practice, China approximates an ethnic nation. The Han Chinese dominate politics, language, custom, and the other identities of the Mongols, the Manchus, the Huis, and the Tibetans have been marginalized. And so this has given reason to tension between the Tibetans and the Han Chinese, between the Uyghurs and the Han Chinese. So we see a conception of this nation in China, a territorial conception that is broad, and an ethnic conception that is narrow, and the tension between the two underlies the conflict and the estrangement of the Tibetans and the Uyghurs from the Chinese nation. The conception of this Chinese nation on an ethnic basis and on a territorial basis also underlies the conflict between the PRC and Taiwan. China sees the population in Taiwan as Chinese, ethnically Chinese, and the Taiwan territory as part of Chinese territory, and so claims and sees unification as necessary on the basis of one nation, one state. The native Taiwanese reject these claims, and that underlies the tension and conflict across the Taiwan Straits. Let me come closer home to Malaysia and read a little bit from what I've written, because I think this would be quite interesting. What we think is new is actually quite relatively old in the Malaysian context. Nationalism and the construction of nation in Malaysia are relatively recent. The beginning of indigenous nationalism is usually traced to the 1946 British Malayan Union proposal that stimulated Malay nationalism and a new sense of belonging and identity among non-Malay populations. In the lead up to 1957, there are several competing conceptions of the Malay nation, including that of a Malay nation, an Islamic nation, and a trans-ethnic, trans-religious Malay nation. Focused on the Malay race and advocated initially by Dato' On in response to the Malay Union proposal, the Malay nation envisaged a Tanah Melayu based on Malay language, custom, and Islam. It would have been the basis for an exclusive ethnic nation. Focused on religion, the Islamic nation concept was advanced by the religious elite who were trained largely in and influenced by developments in the Middle East. The trans-ethnic and trans-religious conception was advanced also by Dato' On after his resignation from UMNO in 1951. He envisioned a Malaysian nation that transcended race and religion. I might point out here that Dato' On is a seminal figure in the history of the nation whose thoughts and contributions have not been accorded sufficient attention by scholars and political leaders. All three conceptions have waxed and waned but continue to be relevant at the present time. The formal Malayan nation, however, was grounded in the 1948 Federation of Malaya Agreement. Envisioning a plural nation with the Malay nation as its nucleus, that conception had ethnic as well as civic nation dimensions. The ethnic dimension related to the special position of the Malays and the Malay rulers, as well as the position of the non-Malays. The civic dimension emphasized citizenship by birth and naturalization, democracy, and the constitutional basis for the Malaysian nation and state. The blend of ethnicity and civic features in nation-making came to be characterized as a historic bargain. Over time, however, the plural and civic nation dimensions of nation-making weakened, with ethnicity becoming paramount in the post-1969 period. Parallel to the growing emphasis on race and ethnicity, religion was emphasized by advocates of an Islamic nation and state. Both these streams create apprehensions and alienation among non-Malay populations who mostly profess other religions, and they became attached to the notions of a Malaysian nation, which provided them a sense of belonging and equality. The conception of a trans-ethnic and trans-religious nation in Malaysia is not new. It has a long history in Malaysia, and it has taken three different forms. One approach to the trans-ethnic Malaysian nation and identity was to broaden the definition of Malay. As Abdul Rahman Embong points out, the term Melayu has been given different meanings in different contexts. In the Malacca Sultanate conception, Malay was defined in civilizational rather than racial terms. That concept of Malay was open to recruitment of outsiders. Javanese, Indians, Chinese, Arabs, and others could become Malays through that conception. A broad conception of Malay was deployed in the 1930s and 1940s by those who argued the case for a pan-archipelagic nation and state. Ibrahim Yaakob's definition of the Malay, for example, included Sumatran as well as Peninsular Malays. Stretching the definition of Malay in another direction, Dr. Burhanuddin of the PMIP was willing to consider using the concept of Bangsa Melayu to encompass Chinese and Indian citizens without the marker of religion. A second approach to trans-ethnic and trans-religious nation identity was a national political community based on citizenship irrespective of race and religion. Dato' On's advocacy for a trans-ethnic and trans-religious nation may be classified as belonging to this approach. A third approach was through the construction of a new Bangsa Malaysia. Dr. Mahathir's vision of a Bangsa Malaysia, articulated in 1991, seeks to create a united Malaysian nation on the basis of one Malaysian race possessing a sense of common heritage and shared destiny. Prime Minister Najib's One Malaysia concept seeks to ensure all citizens belong and take pride in the Malaysian nation while addressing the imbalances across and within ethnic communities. That concept seems to seek restoration of the 1948 understanding as the renewed basis for a nation. After more than 50 years, we are still pondering the basis for a nation. I would hasten to add, this is not without precedent. Nation-making is a long and often torturous process that can suffer reversals. The basis for a nation also changes with time. Time and circumstances cannot be frozen forever. New circumstances and new actors will demand re-examination and forging of new basis for nation and state in all countries. History is important. It determines heritage. At the same time, we cannot submit to the tyranny of history of specific periods. To remain viable, national compacts should be periodically re-examined and renewed. We are now in one of those moments. All three conceptions of the Malaysian nation, ethnic, religious, and trans-ethnic and trans-religious, are all in play. Rather than see any particular articulation as a threat, we should view them as articulations of insecurity, hear them out, and move forward in a balanced manner. So I've talked about China and Malaysia. Both are multi-ethnic states, but engaged in the process of making ethnic nations. I've also talked about Korea and Vietnam, which are ethnically homogenous, but they are unaccepting of divided nations and seek to create one nation, one state, and that has been the driver of the First and Second Indochina Wars, as well as the Korean confrontation across the peninsula. The third approach has been the civic nation-making, which has been followed in India as well as in Indonesia. Both India and Indonesia have had some success with civic nation-making. The vast majority of inhabitants in those two countries identify with the nation-state as constructed, but there are groups that challenge the civic nation model. As I mentioned, in India, both the Sikhs and the Tamils challenge the civic nation of India, but both these challenges have been overcome. Today, a Sikh is the Prime Minister of India, and the Tamils form a key partner in the coalition government in New Delhi. Likewise, in Indonesia, the Achenese and the Papuans contest the Indonesian nation. The Achenese issue has been resolved through a constitutional amendment and grant of autonomy, and the Papuan issue continues. And India continues to face ethnic challenges in the northeast and from Kashmiris. So civic nation-making has been successful in some respects, but it also faces challenges in other respects. So I would not say that either one is better, but it seems that civic nation-making has the potential to address diversity and create a sense of belonging among all people in a country. So I would urge strengthening the civic foundations, and as I mentioned, that ethnicity is not evil, it's not all evil, and cannot be eliminated altogether. In Malaysia, for example, ethnicity is deeply ingrained in our psyche, in the politics, in economics, and so forth, so it's difficult to dislodge ethnicity. But along with ethnicity, we can strengthen the civic foundations of nation. And so that strengthening of civic nation, along with the ethnic nation, will provide all communities in the country with a sense of belonging, identity, and a shared destiny. So with that, I'll conclude my presentation. I'm sorry it has been this very long. Oh my God, I've gone 15 minutes over time, and I do sincerely apologize for this. And so maybe there'll be no questions at this point. Thank you very much.